And now comedian Simon Evans is looking at the funny side of economics, commodities and global markets. This week, in the last of our series, he's looking at the oil trade.
Hello and welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market, Radio 4's premier comedy economic show, with the possible exception of that episode of Money Box Live when Vincent Duggleby audibly ponked during a guide to claiming compensation for missold PPI. Comedy economics is, in fact, a fairly new genre for radio for reasons that are becoming ever clearer to me with each new recording. So new, in fact, that I am in the lucky position of being allowed to name it. Some have suggested Evanomics, but I'll be damned if that bloke off the Today programme gets any credit. So, it's a toss-up between Simonomics and Simonomics. So... Why, when you can no doubt find a rerun of some comedy on Dave that won't require you to furrow your brow in confusion on the way to a punchline, should you choose instead to agree to take some financial roughage with your jokes? Well, to my mind, the world is run by the people who understand this stuff. So if you don't, then you're forever destined to dance to their tune. And yet, it really isn't as complicated as they'd like you to believe. Supply and demand, opportunity cost, comparative advantage. If nothing else, you'll start to understand why you're broke. And surely, if we all spent a little less time cutting coupons out of the paper and driving to that Asda in the retail park in Nottingham to save tuppence on a litre of petrol, and spent that time instead studying the pink pages, it would literally and figuratively pay dividends. So next time you find yourself swearing at your printer as it fails to deliver your precious Pizza Express voucher for free dough balls, stop. Shut down your laptop, get the business section back out of the bin, learn about the markets and get involved. You could become rich beyond your wildest dreams. Or you might lose everything and then you'll have to go the whole hog and move to Nottingham. At least you'll be closer to that Asda. I remember appearing some years ago on an old Radio 4 panel game. It was called something like the News Game... The News Quiz, that was it, the News Quiz. And the panel featured the usual broad range of political sympathies heard on Radio 4's comedy slot, from disgruntled socialist polytechnic lecturer to raving trot. The subject came round to petrol prices, which had been rising fast enough to justify plenty of newsprint, and there was a general sense that the city fat cats were to blame, and I chipped in something to the effect that I too felt that the price rises were due to corporate profiteering and had accordingly just bought a fistful of shares in BP. Stared back at me in much the same way that they would have done if I'd unzipped my skin, unfolded a large pair of leather wings and started flapping around in the radio theatre, swooping down to pluck up their young. Now, you could argue that taking the single least successful joke I'd ever attempted to crack on radio, one which basically ended my career on Radio 4 panel games, and evolving it into an entire four-part comedy series smacks more of revenge fantasy than sensible commissioning. Tonight on Simon Evans Goes to Market, it's the big one, the one which finished off my career on the News Quiz and may still do the same for Mother Earth herself. Yes, it's cowboys. No, it's not. It's not cowboys, it's oil. Now, the oil markets are famously treacherous territory, so to help me find a path through the thickets, I have with me two genuine experts in the field. On the line from her dwelling as ever in financial nirvana, editor-in-chief of Money Week, the highly respected and unusually for an investment pundit, actually quite well off, Merin Somerset Webb. And sitting just to my right, I have FT economist and Radio 4's award-winning statistician, poor but happy Tim Harford. Tim, statistician, perhaps the least exciting word ever to appear after award-winning. But still, a win is a win. Tim, tell me, was the silence of the News Quiz audience that evening more due to embarrassment at my naivety than an affront to theirs?
I'm not sure it was actually an economic critique. I just think they didn't find it funny. But
it wasn't a very good joke, you're right.
But actually, the economics works fine. When your petrol got more expensive, you would have made money on your share portfolio, and that would have hedged your risk.
Well, that's the idea. That's what we're looking for this evening. What is the best way to try and understand petrol, economically speaking, and to benefit from its apparently ever-growing rise in price?
Well, the price of petrol, apart from representing an outrage to Jeremy Clarkson, is a surprising amount of it is actually tax. Petrol at, I don't know, 1.35 a litre, something like that. About 80 pence of that is tax. 45 pence of that is the raw material, the crude oil. About 1.5 pence is the cost of refining it. And a massive 7 pence is the colossal profiteering of the person selling you the petrol.
Wow, that's not a huge margin then, really, for them.
It's not a massive margin. The Chancellor is taking a tremendous amount of money at the petrol pump.
Yeah, crude oil isn't just about petrol, of course. What else do we get from crude?
All sorts of things. So liquid petroleum gas, jet fuel, diesel, plastics, asphalt, lubes.
Lubes? Vaseline.
Yeah,
when they say petroleum jelly. Yeah. This is the stuff you put on blisters if you've forgotten to put it on beforehand.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, interesting. And how much of this stuff do we use at the moment?
We use about 90 million barrels a day.
Who is using the most of that at the moment?
Well, we can blame the Americans. They're using about 20% of the world's oil, although they only have about 4% of the world's population. But of course, any wealthy economy burns a lot of oil. It's interesting, the oil consumption of the rich world, the OECD, hasn't really changed very much for 20 years, while the oil consumption of the rest of the world has nearly doubled.
So the rest of the world is now aspiring to the American lifestyle of driving around in a ludicrously huge SUV, which in turn makes you fat because you no longer walk anywhere, which in turn means you have to buy ever larger cars in order to fit into them. And so perhaps the best way to hedge against petrol prices is actually to buy diet plans for ever-growing larger, fatter people all over the world.
Whatever you say, Simon.
Yeah, OK, well, you know, trying to find some non-conventional ways of profiting. On top of that, we have the question of peak oil. Maybe oil is about to run out.
Which would be worrying if it was true. Now, if we do start to run out of oil, it will drive oil prices up. And there's a surprising connection between oil prices and the world economy. Think about the last 40 years of economic history. We had the 1970s, terrible, terrible economic times, very, very high oil prices. Oil prices fall in the mid-1980s. There's a boom. Some people give credit to Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan, free market economics. Well, you know, maybe a bit of that, but also low oil prices. Then we have the 1990s, the Clinton years, New Labour, everything's going great. We're talking about new technology, but it's also cheap oil. Then we have the dot-com bust. Everyone's worried the economy seems to be slowing down, but we also have expensive oil. And we've had 10, 12 years now of very expensive oil, and we've had a dramatic economic slowdown. Maybe it's the banking crisis, but maybe oil has also played a role. So this stuff really does matter.
This is very serious stuff, and it's not looking like it's going to get cheaper anytime soon. Maybe we are simply screwed, in which case, just go home and build a bunker. However, and on top of all of that, we have climate change, of course. It could really be time for oil and humanity to begin to contemplate conscious uncoupling. OK, let's have a look at the stuff itself. Oil, gloopy, disgusting, magical oil. For Venezuelan statesman Juan Pablo Pérez Alfonso, it was el excremento del diablo, the devil's excrement. Although technically that would suggest that Satan has a largely vegan diet, which seems unlikely. My first memory of oil was from 1978, when the Imoco Cadiz foundered off the coast of France and spilled 70 million gallons of oil into the English Channel. You notice that? Hits France, poisons English Channel. I remember seeing that on Newsround, John Craven in a bad cagoule looking at some seagulls. More disappointed than angry. The only deliberately visible expression of oil I can remember from my childhood was as a lubricant. My dad did have a bottle of something called 3-in-1 oil, and I always wondered what that referred to exactly, but I'm talking about a commercial on the television for Castrol GTX, in which a drop of oil slowly but purposefully made its way across various metallic surfaces before eventually pooling into the open embrace of a spanner. I'm not sure what size the spanner was, Tim.
I think it was a 9/16, Simon, but it's hard to be sure.
OK, that's good enough for me. I don't know if this music will bring it to mind for many of you. It is straight It is curved. It is the precise shape of every moving part it clings to. Oil is too small a word for it. It is liquid engineering. On close examination, of course, that notion doesn't really stand up. Oil is too small a word for it. Many of the things the British respect and understand to be complex and subtle are denoted in monosyllables. God, home, pub. Even in the 1980s, no one ever said, pub is too short a word for it. It is a badly carpeted drinking environment. Still, that was what I thought oil was, a lubricant. Certainly, it was pretty harmless stuff. No one ever really explained to me that oil was why we no longer had to spend most of our lives grubbing for roots or huddled round a warm rock or even what you could really call pushing our own lawnmowers. Even as adults, we are rarely required to confront the stuff. The casual observer would presume that most service stations were simply roadside supermarkets and that their core business was conducted with one of the 18 different Costa coffee outlets per forecourt than with the petrol pumps. It is only right that coffee should be a kind of visible stand-in for petrol at the pumps, of course. Coffee is the second most valuable commodity in the world, after oil, and like oil, it is black, it speeds things up, and it tastes filthy without enough sugar in it. But the essential truth about coffee is that it actually works by poisoning us ever so slightly so that our metabolism accelerates in order to excrete it more quickly. We feel excited as we surge that much faster towards death. And oil works on the planet in pretty much exactly the same way. So both processes end inevitably with an almighty dump. Still... Scatological metaphors aside, perhaps we should ascertain what oil actually is. Tim, tell me, when did we first start getting interested in the stuff? Because we knew it was there, right, for centuries.
We knew it was there, but it didn't seem to be useful for anything very much. It used to get in the way of salt mining and useful stuff like that.
Are you saying people would actually shout, oh no, we've struck oil?
Yeah, yeah. Getting in the way
Happy
of the salt.
Days.
Yeah. And originally, oil came from whales.
Whales?
From sperm whales.
Oh, sperm whales, yeah. Not from where, no, it's the same. Don't tell them that, they'll want independence all over again.
So it came from sperm whales and it wasn't used to drive cars around or anything like that. It was used to light lamps.
So we were hunting whales just to replace candles, just for a finer alternative to candles.
Yeah, and then something terrible happened, which is that we ran out of whales.
Oh, I thought for a minute you were going to say we realised we were being utterly beastly about the whole thing. No.
We're still waiting for that. So we ran out of whales, and then people started trying to figure out whether there was any alternative, and they said, well, maybe this stuff that comes out of the ground in places like Texas, we could use that.
So until this point, people had seen oil for centuries, but it never occurred to them that it could be refined and put to work.
Exactly.
Much like whales, in fact. So this was, what, 1850, 1860s? And for the first few decades, oil was essentially used as a light oil.
Well, what else are you going to use it for? You don't need to use it to run steam engines because you've already got coal. And eventually Winston Churchill came up with a brilliant idea that maybe he could convert the British fleet. This is the early 20th century.
Right.
Maybe he could convert the British fleet to run on oil. And at that point, it started to become geopolitically interesting.
And also at this point, we've already got motor cars appearing in America.
By the 20s and 30s, they're starting to become economically significant. And oil is something you really need if you're going to run a motor car. At which point you get men like John D. Rockefeller becoming, well, by some measures, the richest man in the world. So that all happened really within a human lifetime, from oil being almost irrelevant to oil being the source of wealth of the richest man alive.
So what is it specifically about oil that separates it from these other fuels?
It's brilliant for transport. And the reason is, if you're going to power a car or a truck, you need to carry your fuel around with you. And so it matters how much space it takes up, and it matters how heavy it is. And petrol is extremely light, so that the energy density in a kilogram of petrol is maybe 20, 30, even 50 times greater than the energy density inside a really good battery. And that's why it's still so hard to make electric cars that will run 500 miles and can be recharged really quickly. It's much, much easier to make them run on gasoline.
Just to give it as a comparison, compare it to the power within the human being. How much more... What have you got in a gallon of petrol?
So we could... let's pick an arbitrary unit, like the Wigo. So a Wigo is the amount of power that Sir Bradley Wiggins can generate.
Sir Bradley Wiggins, the Olympic cyclist.
Yeah. And he's quite handy. So he can generate 500 watts for a reasonably extended period of time, sort of 10 or 20 minutes. So if Sir Bradley Wiggins was cycling for 10 hours pretty much flat out, actually he couldn't, but let's assume he could, that would be 5 kilowatt hours. There are 1,600 kilowatt hours in a barrel of crude oil. So that's Sir Bradley Wiggins cycling flat out 10 hours a day for a year.
And that's in a single barrel of oil?
One barrel of oil.
Which currently costs about $100 on the world exchange and is considered to be pricey at that. I mean, that's basically like having an army of slaves at our disposal, isn't it?
I don't like to think of enslaving Sir Bradley Wiggins. not on the radio, anyway.
Wow. It's no wonder this stuff doesn't always bring out the best in us. It's not been an easy transition politically for man to become aware of the value beneath his feet in certain cases. Many countries have suffered from what is known as the curse of oil.
Well, this is what the Venezuelan statesman who talked about the devil's excrement was worried about. He said the Venezuela was going to drown in the devil's excrement. And when you look at places that have struck oil, some have done very well. They've managed to manage it reasonably well. Norway comes to mind. So Norway,
that'd be about it.
Yeah, that's about it. And then you look at Nigeria, for example. Nigeria, between 1950 and the early 1970s, no oil. The shock of independence, massive civil war, killed many hundreds of thousands of people. Much stronger economic growth than Nigeria enjoyed, say, between the 1970s and the end of the 20th century after they struck oil. And many other countries have really struggled because oil skews your economy away from producing almost anything other than oil. And it also really corrodes your political system. You have an entire political system that's basically revolves around some strong guy at the top. He's got control of the oil, and then the money is passed down a pyramid, and you've got an autocratic system. And actually, there are not very many stable democracies which also have a lot of oil.
Like the chalk hills of the South Downs, the golden sands of the Gower Peninsula, and I strongly suspect Marmite, oil is the earthly remains of trillions of long-dead organisms. If you Google the words origins of oil, which I did despite the fact that I am clearly an authority myself, the first result on page one is an article by a Dr. Andrew Snelling, PhD, in which he posits that oil began to form in the immediate aftermath of the catastrophic worldwide Genesis flood. Yeah, that is Google's number one offer for the origins of oil. Essentially, his creationist analysis is that oil is the remains of everything that was uprooted or drowned by the sudden downpour about 6,000 years ago. And given that God sent that flood to punish evil, we have to assume that wherever the oil is, that's where the evil was. Which does at least explain Texas. Saudi Arabia. Aberdeen. Oil is essentially a battery for storing ancient sunshine. Most sober scientists agree that the origins of oil stretch back a little further than 6,000 years, perhaps as much as 500 million. Given that plastic is made from oil, and oil is made partly from dinosaurs, you might well wonder how much of any given plastic dinosaur is actually made of dinosaur. Tim, that feels like a statistical inquiry.
I'm really sorry to break it to you, Simon. It is basically mostly plants.
Mostly plants is okay. But homeopathic quantities of dinosaur.
Exactly.
That's fine. Even now, of course, America, which is, you know, still militarily the most powerful country in the world, an awful lot of its activities, most people squint at and think, where's the oil in this? That's the first thing that people think about them. The war in Iraq, people said, it's a bit of a coincidence that you seem to be interested in spreading democracy in this particular nation. The second largest oil field in the world is the one where you're focused on. But even that, apparently, is a slightly naive reading of the Iraq War. Some people have suggested that the main problem that America had with Iraq was that it was beginning to trade its oil in euros, and that traditionally oil has always been traded in dollars, and that that is the one thing that maintains the dollar's position as the reserve currency of the world. I talked about this to Merrin Somerset Webb, who is editor-in-chief of Money Week, and a very sober and intelligent and well-informed journalist and authority on these things, unlikely to get as overexcited as I would when faced with these sort of sinister notions. But she didn't exactly deny it.
It is conceivable. Yeah. It is conceivable. I have to say, I think it's very unlikely that anyone would be stupid enough to start such an awful war on such a basis. But it is entirely possible. Yes, if it was the case that over the period of a year, everyone switched from buying oil in dollars to buying it in euros, it would have an enormous impact on the US. I think it's called a conspiracy theory because that's really what it is.
She didn't deny it. So... Destabilizing the planet economically, politically, and environmentally, oil really is too small a word for it. It is liquid trouble. Joining me now to try and help me formulate a lifelong investment strategy in the next 5 minutes is the current global head of commodities at Standard Chartered PLC. He was previously managing director and head of commodities research at Barclays Capital and head of energy research at JP Morgan. He's the author of Oil in Asia and Oil Markets and Prices. He holds a degree in philosophy, politics and economics and a doctorate in economics, both from Keble College, Oxford. He is, in short, ludicrously overqualified for the level of questioning I'm going to be capable of taxing him with. And it won't surprise or offend me if he decides to resume a game of online Scrabble on his phone while we're talking. Please welcome Paul Horsnell. Paul, first question, is everything broadly speaking right that we've said so far?
Yeah, I think you may have nailed it. Well, you've certainly used a hammer on it.
This thing of petrodollars, the idea that oil is only traded around the world in dollars. Is that correct?
Oh, 99%.
99%, OK. And how important is that to the security of the American economy?
I think the analogy would be to look at another market, say fashion. Because fashion oil is the same thing, as you can see the way I'm dressed here today.
For those of you listening to this on radio, Paul is very badly dressed.
Gisele Bündchen, the famous Brazilian supermodel, at one point refused to take any payment in dollars. She thought that the dollar was going to go down against the euro, so she was only going to be paid in euros. And she didn't get invaded, so I think it's unlikely.
The point is, the American economy has been stiff for a long time. It has ludicrous levels of debt, and they are utterly profligate. They seem to have no interest whatsoever in balancing their trade deficit or any of the rest of it. And the reason is that they know the world has to own dollars in huge quantities if it wants to do international trade, because it's the world's reserve currency. If people started trading oil in euros, then the dollar would plummet in value. The Americans would no longer be able to import the nice things that they want to live with. There would be riots, and they would be back in the Stone Age or Corn Age or whatever they are, but that's the previous... When Iraq started trading in euros, that did put the wind up them. They were invaded very shortly afterwards, and they are now back to trading in dollars.
Yeah, at the time, actually, Iraq wasn't producing that much oil because it was facing sanctions, so it was a relatively small amount. But you're right, and certainly for the world economy, yes, of course, it matters which currency we traded in. Oil is such a large part of world trade.
OK, I don't want to sound like I'm barking mad, so I'll leave it there, but I still think there's something... Without oil, nothing else functions, nothing else works. It's kind of when you buy into oil, you are buying the heart of the economy. But many people say it's just too volatile to invest in directly. Is there something to that?
Well, a lot of the stock market is made up of oil and gas companies. So in a sense, if you're paying into a pension, you've already got a large exposure to oil and gas. So it's there. And the question is whether you need more exposure. And I think one way to look at the oil industry in the future, it's going to be spending a lot of money. It's got to do a lot of drilling. It's got to build a lot of ships. It's got to move things around. It's got to explore for more. It's got to develop more. It's got to build pipes. There's going to be a lot of money going into companies that actually build things and do things around. The engineering companies, the so-called service companies.
So you would suggest there. Buying shares in Halliburton, basically, and then just waiting for the next big invasion. That's what you're saying?
There are other service companies.
But peak oil is misunderstood. That's not going to happen immediately. It just gets more and more expensive to get our hands on.
I think so. I mean, the best answer to are we going to run out of oil, is the oil age going to end, I think was given by Sheikh Yamani, the famous Saudi oil minister, who had better comic timing than any other OPEC oil minister. So he was asked that question. He paused for a long time, just stroked his beard a bit, and then he answered, the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones.
Using his Stone Age analogy in terms of what we might move on to, alternative energy sources, renewables as they call them, wind turbines, for instance, which seem mainly there to blight Jeremy Clarkson's view of the Cotswolds, which I thoroughly approve of, obviously, and, you know, if they do generate energy at all, it's probably in the heat given off from his face when he looks out of them. They're not really doing anything at all, are they, renewables, compared to the amount of energy delivered by oil?
There's not very much come from renewables yet, but certainly if you look at the carbon dioxide numbers and what we need to do to stabilise carbon dioxide emissions, then those renewables are going to have to make up a much greater proportion. At the moment, oil has got itself very concentrated in these areas, such as transport, where it's very hard to do wind to substitute in for transport. You need a great big windmill on top of your car and it looks a bit silly.
Yeah. Which would be fine once you were going along, but that...
Once you're going along, that'd be absolutely perfect.
And now, as far as the newer sources, shale oil and sand, tar and so on, the impression I get is it's a bit like saying, yeah, there's loads of honey, I dropped a jar of it on the floor over there. You've just got to spit the broken glass out. It's a filthy, nasty, hideous business, and it's never going to be efficient. Is there some slightly latitudinal approach to investing in a future in which oil is never cheap again?
I think for practical purposes, for most people, it is not necessarily probably just the big oil companies, but looking at the small oil companies, who's exploring somewhere interesting, somewhere where there might be oil, but they haven't done much before. Again, who's making those pipes? Who's doing all of this huge amount of activity? So again, it's going to be an industry which will have billions and billions of dollars of expenditure, and we'll need that really just to keep this energy flow going.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Horsnell. So there we have it. Oil has been our slave for 150 years. Virtually everything that you buy, that you own, that you wear, drink, eat, watch, listen to, temporarily endow with erotic charge, has its own little tank. And if all those lovely little items can no longer afford to fill their tanks, then you're going to start noticing. Better hedge now. Buy shares in oil. Or maybe bunkers and Ray Mears box sets. So, what have we learnt? We use 90 million barrels of oil a day, which means, scaling up my favourite Jamie Oliver recipe, we now need 40 million barrels of balsamic vinegar and 20 million barrels of lemon juice. And a really massive piece of salmon. Most of the price of a litre of petrol is actually tax, with petrol stations only making around 7 pence per litre. Most of their money actually comes from Ginster's pasties, although, like petrol, they too are made of organic matter that died a long, long time ago. And you really are better off investing in oil. The reserves are running out, but don't panic. No matter how high the prices rise, no one will ever riot, because you'd have to be a millionaire to afford the petrol bombs. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Good night. To Simon Evans Goes to Market with me, Simon Evans, Tim Harford of Merrin Somerset Webb and Paul Horsnell. It was written by Simon Evans with Benjamin Partridge and Andy Walton, and the producer is Talusha Galani.